Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our adventurous exploration of the cultures of consciousness. But before we get into setting up our guest today, I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating discussion about stimulating, sparkling engagement with issues of the future, technology, human immortality, transhumanist kind of stuff, with a fresh twist, at least in my opinion. I'd like to let people know that the rock opera that I have been working on for many years has finally manifested in CD form. The show, How to Survive the Apocalypse, picks up on some of these transhumanist themes in some ways, but it's also a riff on the peculiar cultural experiment of Burning Man. It's kind of like imagine Hair meets Rocky Horror meets Jesus Christ Superstar at Burning Man, where they all have a love triangle or something. And I wrote the words, and we've done the show up in San Francisco and in Los Angeles. It's a totally fun thing. If you like the kind of stuff I talk about on the show, you might like it. And even though I don't tend to enjoy plugging myself, I'm very, very proud of this puppy. You can get it at CD Baby. But I think I'm just going to play a clip now from the show of a medley of a number of the different songs. The music is by Mark Nichols, and the words are by myself. And so let's just hear a little clip from How to Survive the Apocalypse, out now on CD. From How to Survive the Apocalypse. It actually introduces some of the themes of today's show, because a lot of what we were interested in was communicating this creative, collaborative culture of transformation and, as we say in the show, transmutation, which is an excellent way of introducing our guest today, Jason Silva, who we'll get to in just a moment. But first we'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. Maja, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
You're hanging in there, huh?
I am, yeah.
Very, very good. Yeah, you saw that show, right?
Not a big fan of musicals and plays, I gotta say. So this means a lot coming from me, who's very judgmental. Sorry, everybody who loves plays. But I really enjoyed it. I found it very entertaining and witty and clever. So I liked it a lot.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that little plug. But again, part of what made our drove us to do this crazy thing. It was like years of unpaid work and complete life breakdown and all the stuff that goes along with immense collaborative tasks was really to communicate a certain sense of a kind of optimism in the face of what can seem so often like a mounting pile of terror and incipient doom.
Yeah.
And so with that kind of flavor in mind, I'd like to introduce our very optimistic guest today, Jason Silva. Jason, welcome to Expanding Mind.
For having me.
Yeah, sure, man.
It's a treat because I'm a big fan of yours. I loved Technosis, and I can just totally relate to a lot of the ideas that you talk about, the sort of magical element that permeates our technological universe. And in terms of the idea of increasingly being able to manifest our will in the world, which is what magic was originally about, I just loved how you connected that to the idea of what technology does,
sure.
Or at least we want it to do.
Well, just to say a bit more about you, I mean, what I really like about you, you've done some really excellent short videos that are available online, but are really kind of a nifty way of like approaching some of these big ideas about transhumanism and potential immortality and the way that technology is changing us. And they're very optimistic. They have a kind of psychedelic flavor, a kind of sense of like all of the possibilities that are ahead of us. And for me, seeing those videos in particular and reading some interviews with you, and I know you've been a host on Current TV or whatever,
yeah.
It was really nice because it reminded me of a moment in my life, which was more for me in the 1990s when a lot of these ideas really started to kind of kick up. And at a certain point in my experience, like I sort of fell off of it for various reasons, and I got kind of tired of the way a lot of people were talking about it.
Huh.
You have this kind of interesting spin on it that's at one sort of classic, like it reminds me of, you're definitely tied into some of these ideas about technology, about psychedelics, about the imagination, about this kind of, exuberance to grab a hold of the bull by the horns.
Yeah.
But you kind of bring it into there's a fresh flavor to it. And so, you're doing something kind of interesting with getting these ideas out there and almost just trying to get the vibe out there, like get people to feel the wonder again, which is because it's such a different era than when I first encountered these ideas. So before we get into the concepts, because I have no doubt that we're going to be able to run wild with all the possibilities and discussions, but I just want to get a little bit of background from you. I mean, you're from Venezuela.
Yeah.
Find your way somehow into the media scape. So tell me a little bit about how that came about.
Well, yeah, I grew up in Caracas, Venezuela, and I went to one of these like international schools. So I grew up with sort of a multitude of students from all over the world. Exposed to all these different cultures, bilingual and whatnot. Ended up in university in the States. Studied philosophy and film because as long as I can remember, I was sort of an ideas person. My mom is an educator. She teaches high school literature, but she's very much like that kind of sort of hippie teacher that tells everybody to follow their bliss. Minds are like parachutes. They only function when open, and she was also very much an artist. So I was sort of exposed to an environment of just it being encouraged to articulate feeling, to chase curiosity, to be as erudite as possible in articulating your bliss and whatnot. And so film school, University of Miami, resulted in me doing a documentary with a friend of mine. It was like a 12-minute short called Textures of Selfhood, which was inspired by David Pierce's website, The Hedonistic Imperative, which talks about using technology to genetically pre-program ourselves into blissful immortal states. And And so the doc that I did in college explored these ideas about engineering divinity for ourselves, engineering a sort of neo-hedonism where we could have pleasure and infinite knowledge. I mean, this just appealed to the part of me that loves science fiction and loves a sense of anything is possible and this and that. And the film ended up in the hands of the executives at Al Gore's new TV network, which was focused on citizen journalism and giving a voice to the voiceless. It was going to be this, like, independent media cable channel, and out of thousands and thousands of applications, they ended up asking me and my friend, actually, to both come on board and become kind of like the video jockeys on the network, tossing to all these citizen journalism pieces. So it was a great kind of way to kind of, I don't know, get into the media scene that way and have the platform for my ideas. So I did that for the last 4 years, but always gravitating more towards the intersection of science, technology, and art, and sort of it has gotten me to this point now where... Well, first of all, do you have any questions on what I just said?
Oh, you know, I mean, there's any number of points to riff off. I did want to say a little bit, you're really, you know, lucky when you talk about your mom and that kind of teaching philosophy. You know, I mean, there was a certain era when people grew up when there were a lot of those ideas in education, and at least in America, a lot of that's really crushed out because everybody's, you know, studying for the test.
Oh, I totally agree. In fact, I loved Sir Ken Robinson's TED Talk about how education kills creativity. It's one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen. And I personally went to elementary school for the Montessori system, and that very much encourages kind of like individual passion and finding your own way rather than trying to be, you know, forced into this like reality tunnel and this mold as if, you know?
No, it makes a huge difference. I mean, I went to, you know, normal, quote-unquote, public schools, but it was in, you know, Southern California in the 70s, and they were very kind of innovative. Like, they were like these multi-grains, and there were all these sort of open partitions that they would be rearranged, and people could go at their own pace. And you know, a lot of times when I think of, like, how did I become such a weird guy, I'm like, look back and I'm going, it's like stuff that I got programmed with then. I mean, I didn't want to spend all the time talking about that, but it just seemed really interesting to me because I think part of staying optimistic and part of having kind of a visionary attitude towards the world despite all of the problems, it's a certain kind of like somewhere along the way somebody allowed that. Someone said, hey, that's fine, go ahead, you can do that, people do that. And you're like, oh yeah, you can do that. I mean, Terrence McKenna would talk about, he goes, you know, sometimes I think the only point I have is to give people permission.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny you mentioned Terrence McKenna because he's one of my heroes, and some of my favorite lines that he came up with, you know, have to do with this relationship between technology and human possibility, where he talks about, you know, how 50,000 years ago with the invention of language, you know, biological evolution was trumped in favor of this cultural epigenetic phenomenon whereby the human mind takes in matter of little organization, puts it through its mental filters, and extrudes it in the form of iPhones, which gives us technologically mediated telepathy, or jet engines whose core temperature operates at half the temperature of the sun, and each blade is like a freight train, and space shuttles that take us to space. So it's this idea that, like, you know, matter with very little purpose and very little complexity and organization, having gone through the filters of our mind, then gets reinstantiated in the world, transformed into something that boggles the mind. And I find just that idea ultimately permeates all of my work, because I find it to be kind of like an antidote to existential despair. Like, to me, there's like two ways to be. You can be, or three rather, you can be a zombie, or you can be in like the complete existential despair of knowing you are mortal and the universe seeming completely meaningless, you know, a la Woody Allen. Or you can look at this other perspective, which is like, you know, the Carl Sagan philosophical ruminations about the infinite cosmos, or looking at like the idea of self-organization in the universe, and just all these other things that are just so much more, so astonishing that I sort of get off on them. I find them to be just like, call me a wonder junkie. So I'm a junkie for wonder. You know, one of my favorite types of museums is an air and space museum, because I like to look at the complexity and these sort of astonishing things that human beings can engineer into existence. So that's really what it comes down to, is what we can do, you know?
Do you find that the majority for you, for your astonishment and wonder, then lies in the technologies that people produce? Like, I'm just curious, because for me, what strikes my, like, wonderment is always the construction and complexity within nature. And, like, say, in a cell, to me, like, I just just get, like, totally cuckoo when I look at the purpose in a cell.
Yeah.
But for you personally, do you find it's more, like, kind of in those things that we make rather than, like, the... Like, I mean, you called, like, the matter kind of boring, and, I mean, you didn't use the word boring, but, like, and that this releases it. But to me, the exciting thing is that those potentialities are kind of within the matter all along.
Well, sure,
and it
really
kind of, like, comes out.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but, like, you know how Buckminster Fuller used to say, start with the universe, and so from the perspective of the long view, you know, Earth is this singular system, so there really is no distinction between the man-made and the natural, really,
from
the long view, because it's all natural. You know, people say, oh, artificial intelligence. It's not artificial intelligence. It's life creating life. You know, it's a natural phenomenon. The same natural phenomenon that sprouted a flower, you know, sprouts a microprocessor.
Right.
And something that really does blow my mind is when the patterns that we find in complex human creations mirror certain complexities that are found in nature. So like when the mycelial pattern shows up when you map the internet, and it's like the same as like a nerve in the brain, and it's like the same as like the galaxies in space. So transcalar recurring patterns of reality, natural systems, man-made systems. I mean, it all blows my mind. But I guess what it is, there's this wonderful line written by Tom Robbins, who was writing about marijuana and creativity. And he was saying that it's not the plant genies that give us wonderment, but rather that they force us out of context so intensely that they make us, that we find ourselves gawking in astonishment at the ubiquitous everyday wonders that we're culturally conditioned to ignore. And even though he was talking about marijuana, I think that that applies really to any kind of person who's curious and who's a wonder junkie versus like the other way of perceiving things. Like, to me, it's sad how many of us go through life not gawking in amazement at how astonishing the universe is, you know, or man-made structures, technology, intelligence. I guess I'm interested in being in awe as often as possible. It's like that scene in When Harry Met Sally, and Sally fakes the orgasm in the restaurant, and then the old lady says, I'll have what she's having. Well, that's how I feel when I listen to Carl Sagan wax philosophical about the universe. That's how I feel when I read Ray Kurzweil describe the singularity. Like, I'm like, I'll have what he's having. I want that
feeling. You know, it's funny. I think that's now we're getting in on what it is about what I like about your stuff is that you manage to combine like the cognitive picture, whether it's like the big picture of the universe or the specific technology or ideas about complexity or ideas about, you know, systems and communication or whatever. But you communicate this kind of like, you know, bliss in the cognition, which is something I'm totally interested in. You know, a lot of people talk about, like, you know, altered states.
Yeah.
And, you know, the different variations of them and what's exciting about it. And a lot of people, the way they talk about it, it's clear that what they appreciate about them is it's, like, experience, like a new kind of experience, whatever it is, like blissful or intense or whatever. And I'm really interested in that place where affect, you know, emotion, the intensity is coupled with knowledge. Coupled with understanding and even kind of revelation, where like part of what you're getting, like if you have that vision of the interconnection of nature, even the interconnection of nature and technology, you know, whatever, you're looking at a map of the internet and you see the mycelial pattern, you know about mycelium and how they operate, and you start to go like, oh, the mushroom is the internet of the planet or whatever, and you're having that kind of vision, there is this sort of, you know, whatever, trippy aspect of it where, like, the pattern seems to be swallowing you up and there's something kind of poetic about it.
Totally.
But you're also understanding something. You're also kind of seeing something cognitively about the world, which may be, you know, distorted from other perspectives. But it's a good thing to communicate, because I think a lot of times part of the reason that people are cut off from certain kinds of wonder, whether or not they're looking at it in terms of technology and that side of things, is just that there's a disconnect between the world of knowledge, which is this kind of dry world where you have to take a test, and then you have to know things for your job, and you gotta like know things in order to make decisions about what thing you're gonna buy for your household. And then there's this other world where you just like have pleasure.
Right.
And it's like,
I think you guys also left something out that bears mention in your kind of like threefold explanation of how you can be with the zombie and everything, Jason. I think it's important to realize too, there are some people that have that experience, but the result of it is not bliss or ecstasy or wonder, but it's a profound melancholy. And I think that part of that emotional response too, Eric, that you're talking about can be that you can experience those things, and I think like the line between bliss and ecstasy and melancholy are a little, you know, sketchy, but I think there's something to be said for those like Capricornic Edgar Allan Poe's that can see it and not just kind of like revel in it in astonishment, but then also take it to the below where they go into the caves and the caverns with it as well. And I think that's an important other kind of counterpart to
yeah, mention. Well, you know, I'm interested in a concert of dialogues that, you know, they can intertwine with one another and sometimes agree and sometimes disagree. But in terms of the emotional feeling, I've always been in love with the term aesthetic arrest, you know, or revelatory ecstasy, which is to say the ecstatic bliss that can come when you apprehend something. Now, there's this wonderful line that says, to understand is to perceive patterns. And so it's like when you get an aerial view, a larger dot connecting pattern that subsumes the previous paradigm. It's like when you get on a plane and you take off and all of a sudden you get a radically different perspective from the top of the ground and you see the order and you see how it comes together. And it's this experience that epiphanizes as that moment when you get the long view and it instantly communicates some grander vision. You know, there's this wonderful website called Visual Complexity, which is experimenting with the new possibilities of big data, which is something that everybody's talking about now. It's the new buzzword, big data. What I love about this idea is that we're measuring so much more than ever before, and we have the computational power to create beautiful visualizations of all these new things that we can measure. And it's this idea that the more we can measure, the more we can see. So it's this idea of technology that allows us to see more, to measure more, is literally mind manifesting and mind expanding. Technology becomes psychedelically informed, just like a microscope or a telescope, show us the realities that we're not privy to of the very small and the very large. So
sure,
too,
or like
now,
the space picture of the planet Earth or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that, yeah.
When you have a website like Visual Complexity showing you, you know, all the movements of traffic in Portugal, or, you know, the flight patterns of airplanes over London, or, you know, the hub network structures that persist in all these human systems, but like this is so much data that an individual mind could not process it all at once unless you visualize it. And then you visualize it, and all of a sudden you can process it all at once. And what that does is it transforms the perception of who and what we are, and it radically recontextualizes how we see ourselves unfolding in this universe. And so,
one aspect of that about that kind of, because I'm really also interested in that, in the visual patterning and then how people deal with and model and extract patterns from large data sets, is that to varying degrees, it requires you to use old sort of 70s language, the right side of your brain. That there's a kind of intuitive, poetic, artistic dimension to it. Because if you look at like the way that like complex data sets, not even just complex sets, but just a lot of scientific data is visualized. And if you look really close at it, like, you know, people who are like sociologists of science look at how these images get constructed. I mean, even images from the Hubble telescope or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You realize that there's all these points along the way where decisions are made that are really more about art than they are about science.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that those decisions themselves can then stage new kinds of understanding that are analytic. But they have this kind of, it's like a back and forth. I mean, you talk about the connection between science and art a lot in your stuff, and that's one place where we really see it close up, is how certain kinds of ways of representing data, drawing from images, drawing from patterns, drawing from graphs, and how we process images, stage these higher order, you know, kinds of groks of what's going on. It's a very exciting way. But I have a different kind of question. I mean, you know, I'm like Maja there. Like, I spend a lot of time in my, you know, Saturnine cave. You know, that's just kind of the way I am. Have you just always been like this? I mean, have you just always been like up? You like?
No, I mean, no. There's two sides to the coin, because this still is my way of dealing with, you know, like, for example, when I first read Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death, right? It talks about how human beings are the only animals that are cognizant of our mortality, and that's not true, though. Yeah, but it's not that we are sexually repressed, and that's why we're neurotic, as was the whole Freudian school of thought, but it's the fact that we're neurotic because we know that we're going to die, and no matter how stunning and intelligent and amazing and loving our art and our poetry and our relationships are, we are still ultimately food for worms. So to be godly yet creaturely, to be gods with anuses, with our minds being able to ponder the infinite yet finding ourselves in a heart-pumping, breath-gasping, decaying body, you know, that recognition is very visceral in me, and I find that that makes me fucking depressed. I mean, that makes me think there is absolutely no justification for the mass murder, the sentence to death that all humans are born with.
Well, I guess that depends on how you see death. If you see it as some ending, like a cessation, then of course that's going to be depressing. But I think, like with a lot of animals too, like one of my favorite things that my friend told me was his German Shepherd was very old, and the German Shepherd knew he was going to die, so he went out in the backyard and dug himself a hole and laid down in it. He basically made himself his own grave. And you see, like, or like how elephants perform before they're going to die. They are not neurotic, even in the knowledge that the death is going to come. So if you have fear of death, I think that happens. But if you see death as continuity, then I don't know that that's such a big deal.
No, but I think that that continuity that you speak about is very poetic, sure, but I guess it doesn't make me feel better about the thought of one day not being able to call my mother and tell her that I love her. You know, it doesn't make me feel any better, you know, when I listen to a beautiful song and I'm looking at old photographs of people that I love and I think of what it would be like if they stopped existing. You know, I don't think there's any way that that could ever be beautiful, but that's just my opinion, regardless of the continuity thing. But in terms of going back to then, have I always been so optimistic? It's like I said, the art is like a drug. The ideas are like a drug. They get me out of that dark place and put me in a different space where I'm looking at these recurring patterns across different scales of reality, and I'm looking at the complexity, and I'm looking at what's possible, and they just, they fill me with this anti-dread vaccine that is my reason for being, so to speak. You know, Roland Barthes, the poet, in The Lover's Discourse, he wrote about how fulfillment is that which exceeds totality, to be more than full, to spill over. You know, when I listen to something beautiful, when I witness something beautiful, it makes me sad because the beauty that it hints at is the exception. But there's also something kind of nice about succumbing to that sadness because it's enveloping and it's nurturing, and it just feels really good sometimes to have that catharsis. You know, we're all chasing it in movies and art and ideas. We're chasing catharsis.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, again, part of that catharsis, it opens up some perspectives, closes other ones, and you know, it's here's another way of approaching the question. So you talked about earlier how, from the Terrence McKenna perspective, you know, one of the things that I learned from him as well, it sounds real similar to you, is that you can look at like human history and all of the things that have you know, that we've created, and look at them not just as like technological innovations or political, you know, institutions or new kinds of architecture, but instead this just evolving materialization of some kind of imaginative capacity, some
100%.
Kind of way of creating a space for possibility that then incarnates in like actual
100%.
Material reality.
Yes.
So then, you know, so I was already kind of programmed with that idea, or whatever. I was excited by that idea. It was a way of understanding the kind of alchemy of history, and I could see the way you could draw this kind of, you know, picture from it. And then the more, you know, and I'm not a, you know, a peak oil kind of guy, but the more I understood about the way that petroleum sort of hyper drove that process over the last 120 years, meaning that, you know, if we look back at the 20th century and the way that this process of kind of the alchemizing of technology and you know, the material transformation of the world, even if leaving aside the question of whether that's a horror show or not,
right,
just if you look at it, you go, well, one thing is true. There's no way this would have happened without petroleum, because petroleum is a very unusual power source. It's not like we run out of petroleum and then we can just turn to, you know, sunlight in the same kind of way, because it packs so much punch. It's so cheap. It's so cheap for the bang. And when I started to do the science of that, and that, again, this has nothing to do with peak oil, it's just the way that petroleum is and the fact there's nothing like it out there, even close, is that when I understood that, I got another glimpse of that process that Terrence was talking about, at least as far as the 20th century goes, because I was like, oh, what we're seeing is not just the expression of the human imagination in materiality, we're seeing like the human imagination on petroleum, like almost like on drugs. Like petroleum has enabled us, has given us the energetic platform to take that manifestation to this extraordinary level.
Oof, that's incredible. I mean, what you just said, that's the kind of stuff that I get off on just listening to that.
Right, but then here's the question. Is then you go, okay, but we're clearly starting to get some serious blowback from the petroleum economy. And yeah,
yes,
maybe new power sources will come down, new energy sources.
Yes.
Maybe there's some technological fixes right around the horizon. But I think a lot of people, even very reasonable people who aren't, again, on the fringe, go, this is kind of unsustainable. And so then it produces this really interesting problem, which is like, I totally see the alchemical transformative force of history, and it like excites me, and it blows my mind. I'm awestruck, but maybe there's something else for us now. Like maybe the imagination has to go in another direction, or not. I don't know, and I'm just kind of curious to get your riff on it.
Well, but like I said, I mean, what you just said is just such a brilliant, insightful kind of take on the whole thing. So, yeah, like, that's this crazy drug that allowed these radical new things to instantiate in this crazy complexity. But if the model is unsustainable, we shall have to use this technology to create the next one. I mean, we will have to use our ingenuity to solve that issue, or we won't. And if we won't, we fail, right? But again, like, if we do, you know, there's this wonderful website called futuretimeline.net, which is kind of like a reverse timeline into the future, and it kind of dates, like, you know, the seven stages of mankind, you know, harnessing the energy of the star, and then harnessing the energy of the solar system, and then the universe. And, I look at that, and I'm like, well, here's one great map we could try to emulate and follow. Seems like the best alternative, in the face of things. But yeah, no doubt. I mean, if the system as it is right now is unsustainable, we need to outwit our limitations. Definitely.
That's an excellent place. So we got to take a break right now.
Okay.
This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Jason Silva about the future and all sorts of transhumanist possibilities. And we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis and Jason Silva. And we're talking a little bit about alchemy, immortality, and technology. And Jason, this is something I always like to kind of get into when transhumanism comes up. And I know
You
have written a little bit and gotten into like the idea of immortality and gods. And that's something I spend a lot of time thinking about too. And
cool.
I mean, with all the advances in technology, I always kind of like go back to the ancient stories of like the Gollum and Frankenstein and the implications. Like, how Eric was talking about with the, the ramifications of the petroleum. I mean, a lot of that is like a pattern that repeats that goes back to the ancient alchemists.
Yeah.
And so I was just kind of curious, like, what your take is. Like, we can develop these technologies that can extend immortality, but they get pretty, Frankenstein-y. We got, like, human cow embryos and all this kind of stuff going on. So what do you think? Like, I mean, a lot of this is, like, humanity trying to extend itself in an exterior fashion, searching for these, like in the kind of Western modality.
Yeah, yeah.
But you look at a lot of the Indian and Chinese alchemists, and they all went into the body to pursue those things. I mean, what have you in your research kind of delved into any of those, like,
I hear where you're coming from, but I still go back to this idea that that those cautionary tales usually stem from fear and not knowing. I think the whole Frankensteinian thing, I mean, I'm sure when medicine was in its infancy back in the day, there were many that opposed it and said, oh, you're not supposed to tinker with nature. It's God's will. Cancer is God's will. Genetic defects that, make millions of people suffer, God's will. I think that we're defined by our ability to transcend our limitations, to transcend our boundaries, you know, to search for the adjacent possible, as Stephen Johnson writes. I keep going back to that idea. You know, like when we first, you know, it's like the Nicholas, the guy that wrote The Shallows, he says the internet is changing our brain. But, I mean, look, when we invented writing, like, wasn't it Socrates that said, oh, it's going to rot the brain, you're writing things down, you're not going to remember them. And then they said the same thing about the phone, and they said the same thing about... I tend to side with Kevin Kelly's idea, where he says, imagine how impoverished we would have been if we hadn't invented the technology of musical instruments in time for Beethoven and Mozart to unfold through it. Imagine if we hadn't invented the technology of oil painting in time for Van Gogh to bring his beauty through that, or the technology of the alphabet that, as Eric has written, engenders alphabetic rapture that allows, you know, Shakespeare to use the technology of the alphabet to compose his sonnet. I see technology as a scaffolding, as Andy Clark wrote in Natural Born Cyborgs, that extends our thought, reach, and vision. That's how I see it. I don't see these technologies as separate from we are. I think when I'm listening to my iPod and I'm listening to the score, you know, by Hans Zimmer for the movie Inception, and I'm getting the goosebumps, I don't think that that's just like artificial technology thing. I think
you're mentioning a lot of very positive things, right? But then there's also the like horrifyingly destructive things as well. So I guess like my obviously there's plenty of good stuff we get from technology too, but then there's all kinds of like horrifically destructive things as well, which I think bear mention. And with all the Beethovens, there's also like nuclear bombs and stuff
but
the question is, like, how do we, like, kind of smartly, you know, look at these things that might be harmful, or is there a way even, should we just, like, do whatever we can do and not really consider ramifications? Or, I mean, in your opinion, like, what do you think is, like, a solution to navigating from, like, Beethoven to nuclear bombs?
Yeah.
Like, how can we kind of, like, find some medium?
Culture. That's how we do it. That's what great art is. It steers the emotions and the narratives of our societies. You know, like, we can't blame the technologies, because the technologies are just a metaphor for the extension of us. So the conversation is about us, not about the technology. You know, the man that invented or that discovered how to make fire was probably burned at the stake by his contemporaries. You know, you can use the technology of the alphabet to write a Shakespearean sonnet, or you can use it to write hate speech on the internet. You know, the internet can extend and empower many, but it can be used by the Ku Klux Klan to start a website. So you could use, you know, Stuart Brand did a TED Talk, I think it was last year or the year before that, that, you know, he said that nuclear energy today, we have the nuclear technology, that it can be super safe and super effective. And I'm thinking that as a pragmatist, and I'm like, that's true. You know, nuclear doesn't have to be used to make nuclear weapons. So it's not the technology, it's how we use it, because at the end it's an extension of who and what we are. And
you know,
how
sometimes
we...
what I imagine, you know, this is like, I can't tell whether this is an optimistic or pessimistic scenario, but I sometimes, you know, you have that sense of like, wow, you know, things on Earth are kind of weirdly set up. It's almost like we're like a petri dish, or like some kind of like program, that like some kind of like genetic algorithm that was set going in order to see what was happening. And I sometimes imagine like the, you know, like these sort of like anthropologists from the galactic core who are, you know, vastly beyond, you know, and they come back to our sort of like planet right on the verge of this weird kind of like, you know, galactic presence, like we're picking up radio signals that are going through space now, and it's like, oh, they seem to be turning on, and then they come and like check us out, and they don't care about like the wars and the horror, and they're just like, yeah, you know, that's just how it is, life in the universe. But what they're interested in is like all of the jewels. They're like, you know, nobody else had a Shakespeare. Nobody else had a, you like, or, you know, not to just emphasize like the genius people, but just that it's the extrusions of our art and poetry and passion and, you know, imagery and painting and film. Like, that's what they're interested in. They're like, you know, there's going to be a lot of bad stuff that goes along with that. And I mean, in a way, that's kind of what I like about your rap is that I, you know, even though I think like a lot of people these days, you know, you have a much harder sell now than you would have, you know, at certain points outside of certain worlds, because a lot of people are very, you know, kind of shocked by the degree of the problems that we face, and a real recognition about how some of the blindnesses within human society, including some of its own, you know, exuberant embrace of its own creativity, are, you know, have to do with creating some of these these issues. But at the same time, I do think we forget that, you know, human societies, in most cases, were, you know, had some seriously bleak aspects to them. You know, even in your most kind of utopian view of what the, you know, hunter-gatherer life was like, or the most peaceful sort of Neolithic village, or but at the same time, there are these opportunities for these moments, these poems that have never been, you know, in existence before, you know, and that in some ways it feels like, you know, our part of our job is to, like, keep dreaming in the face of...
Well, and part of those poems and the Shakespeare's arise out of the, like, most gnarly crisis, horrible tragedies become the inspiration for the jewels, too.
Well, yeah, but in that case, then we should... Are you saying we should accept all the consequences of our unsustainable actions because they might inspire new poems?
Well, no, I'm saying this is the reality. This is it's happening, right? It's part of us,
yeah.
Like you say. I mean, I'm not talking about my personal opinion. I mean, my personal opinion, usually everyone just thinks I'm a freak and a weirdo, but...
Oh, no.
but, no, to me, I think this we have to look at reality of what is existing. I mean,
yeah.
I, like you, think technology is just part of nature. So I think it's more about navigating
sure. The
direction we're going in a
yes. Conscious
manner than just allowing it to unfold... I mean, in places like human cow embryos, you know.
Yeah, no, well, that's the whole thing. I mean, now evolution can be self-directed, and
exactly. Now
it can be faster for us to, you know, synthesize new genetic sequences that change the course of the evolution of this planet rather than letting it happen through natural selection. Or, you know, from the long view, it's still natural selection,
well,
because
exactly. If
we succeed, right. It means that we were naturally selected to trump the natural selection process. So,
right. But
does that make sense?
It does a lot. And I mean, to me, that's a lot of people that kind of critique transhumanism and even the quest for immortality, I think, in general, are ones that do, I mean, you know, there's no short amount of literature on these cautionary tales and things.
Yeah.
They exist in every single culture from shamanism
yeah.
on up. So, I mean, it's a definite contingency that is there right alongside it.
Yeah.
Well, the question I have for you is I've always been interested in the immortality debate, and I've thought a lot about it, and I have very kind of mixed feelings about some of the claims that are made on both sides, really. I mean, meaning people who are, like, rigorously defend the need of death as part of human consciousness and culture, and then you have on the other side people who say that that's just bollocks and that people are just afraid. And so, you know, I have my own opinions on it, but really the question I had for you was more about how you see other people react to that rift. Because one of the things about the immortality line that's so interesting is that if you present it to people, it's amazing how much resistance people have.
Oh, yeah. Well, because it sounds so impossible. It goes against everything that they know. Most people probably think that biologically engineered or, you know, technologically engineered immortality is somehow more impossible than the idea that there's a heaven and your spirit will live forever in that heaven.
Well, what's so stupid is that it exists in nature. I mean, there's trees that are like 5,000 years old.
Oh, there's a jellyfish that renews
itself. Yeah, totally.
Itself
so that's what I always, when people think it's impossible, I'm like, look, dude, it's happening right now on the Earth. So
yeah.
Wait, what's a jellyfish?
Childlike state.
It goes back to an embryo.
Yeah, indefinitely.
Wow.
It
an
never
immortal
dies.
Organism, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
amazing. Well, so I'm curious, what excites you about this stuff right now? What are you looking? I mean, what is there new research? Are there new people? Or what's worse? What's going on in that kind of
The word immortality also is a very powerful word. I mean, it implies billions, trillions of years. I mean, who knows? Maybe we won't get there in time when the sun burns out. But it's this idea of radically extended lifespans. You know, I mean, people used to die at 37, then it was 45. You know, now people push 80. You know, I think it's a tragedy, you know, that Steve Jobs died at 56, man. Like, the guy made such a contribution to the world. He's an icon. It's the most horrific tragedy that I can imagine is to a man like that, with all the resources at his disposal, we still didn't have the science to save him. I mean, that's just... I mean, horrific. And we already have the technology to feed everybody in the world, so we should leverage those emerging technologies for that. You know, thankfully, there's institutions now that are teaching people how to leverage emerging technologies to help a billion people. Yeah, Singularity University is focused on that. So we have the technology for that. But eventually, you know, once we solve poverty, which I do think we will solve, I still think that the fact that we all have to die is kind of horrific. And why not just radically extend our lifespans, you know? it's no more impossible than the idea of flying machines and telepathy and satellite TV and all these other things that we take for granted. That,
well, and again,
you know,
I have to hearken back to olden days, too. I mean, the stories of people living thousands of years are also extant in, like, the majority of ancient cultures. So whenever people say it's impossible, I mean, there's right now on the Earth some Taoist and Indian dudes that people say are over 300 years old that they have, like, some possible corroborative evidence for.
Right.
So,
well,
I mean, it's just, it's kind of dumb that we have this reaction. It's just, to me, it just indicates how quickly we forget our own history.
Yeah, and there's also that wonderful, there's this French romantic poet who wrote finite in his, or finite in body, infinite in his desire, man is a fallen god who remembers heaven. So it's just this idea, this conundrum that goes back to that Ernest Becker notion. You know, with our minds we can ponder the infinite, but we're housed in a heart-pumping, breath-gasping, decaying body. So it's like to be godly and creaturely is such a difficult thing to live with. You know, to be reminded that we are flesh at the same time that we are, you know, capable of the writing the music that we write and the poems that we write. I just, it's that paradox almost, you know.
It's like, well, it's really interesting, like, how threatening that is to certain kinds of religion. And I don't want to talk about it like just the cartoon, like the Dumbos and the people who are just mired in fear or whatever. I'm even talking about the most kind of beautiful, philosophically sophisticated, subtle aspects of major religious traditions have their own ways of trying to deal with that conundrum.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because you just realize like how much that the paradox itself ends up being kind of like the point. Like it's the, and that's a part of it that I can kind of, that's the place where I can kind of get behind. It's not no, human beings are structured to die. We would be miserable if we would live forever. Go,
right.
Man, I'm sure that when it comes to my time, like, unless I'm really depressed, I'll be like, can we keep rolling here for a little while?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and, but the, that one other part is, I think the part of it is that there is some kind of mystery in precisely in that conundrum, in that conjunction where we're limited and at the same time we can see the heaven that is part of what, not in a limited way, but it's part of like what drives Shakespeare or drives Van Gogh. And the part that I have the most trouble with, the kind of, this isn't a problem, Kurzweil approach, where like, you know, life gives a meaning to itself,
right?
Is that I don't think it acknowledges the degree to which certain kinds of limitation and striving are necessary for the kinds of creativity that we are already familiar with.
Right.
That
makes diamonds,
there is
I would
new
say.
Stuff.
No, it makes perfect sense because certain creativity has to be directed, and sometimes you can direct it by putting limitations on certain ends of it that direct it in another direction. So having this death thing right here forces the creativity to sprout in the most immense ways possible because in a way it's faced with the most immense limitation at the end. But my idea is if the universe is infinite, why can't we be, you know? And as big as the cosmos seems to be, as vast as it seems to be, and as long as just even the Earth has been around, billions of years, I mean, why can't individual self-aware entities like us linger around for a couple million years more? You know, like, I don't think it's a lot to ask, not when compared to the scales at which the rest of the cosmos seems to deal with.
Well, I mean, that's really the heart of what all the ancient alchemists were after, right, is what is the part of us, the prima materia, right, which is undying and never stops. And that is, to me, I think it's the self-aware consciousness. And then that gets into all the religious stuff. But listen, the self-aware consciousness exists in our meat suits, right? I mean, that is where it happens. With the meat suit hands is what makes the Beethoven play the piano, is what is the generator of all these things. And people think of spirituality and enlightenment and all this stuff is happening in some spiritual realm, like you get enlightened and then all of a sudden that's like some spirit world, but that all happens on the planet Earth, on the dirt, in the pooping machine, you know? So I can't help but see those two as like a kind of inseparable entity. And so I think the continuity, even though the flesh might shift, even on an atomic level, on a like thermodynamic where energy is never created or destroyed, destroyed kind of level, I think it continues no matter what the shape of the earth it's in. But then, I mean, for you, people don't like to disassociate it with the meat suit they're in. So then it becomes like this kind of issue, right?
Well, I just, you know, I think every pattern needs a substrate. And so the meat suit leads to the emergence of this pattern. But then when the meat suit dies, the pattern requires a different substrate. So I feel like, you know, why can't we create a housing for that pattern that is decentralized? I mean, so that our consciousness doesn't have to be bound by biological entropy. I mean, our bodies are pretty freaking frail. I mean, we can certainly make things that are more durable than our bodies. So I'm just thinking, why not direct that technical proficiency and you know, use it on ourselves, too?
Right.
No, I'd sometimes just like to imagine, like, being inside of some kind of, like, large, you know, like, robot truck thing. You know, it's like not so much like, you know, like downloading my head into a computer. That seems like it could be a real drag. I can only take so much of the internet now. But the
lawnmower
idea of being
man,
some kind of weird exoskeleton where you're able to, like, you know, climb through, you know, immense jungles and move up and down and all that kind of, that sounds kind of fun.
It does. And also, you know, when people talk about the technicalities and whether or not it's feasible, but at the end of the day, I just think that if, and you did this in Technosis really well, just looking at the things that we already have assimilated and therefore fail to appreciate how astonishingly almost impossible they are, but we use them all the time. Even like language. I mean, I think when you, in Technosis, Eric, you wrote about how little graphical units, you know, written on stone tablets leap off the stone and into the mind in the form of rich images and ideas and stories and narratives. It's this the translation of text and word, information transporting itself through time and space. The first time that information was being exchanged without DNA actually having sex with other DNA, like, that's amazing. That's impossibly amazing. Impossibly astounding.
Well, that happens in nature, too. I mean, there was that Burmese python that did chimera style, and she got pregnant and gave birth to 20 snakes without a male.
Yeah, okay, so there you go.
Yeah.
So, amazing.
Totally,
so
and it happens
because
in
we have
nature
a value,
right now.
Yeah, so because we have a value system, and we can sort of recognize certain things like, you know, love, relationships, health, cooperation, human compassion, empathy. Why cannot we use these values to serve ourselves so that we don't have to be afflicted by the horror of mortality? I mean, it's like, I don't know. I read David Deutsch. I've been reading David Deutsch's new book, The Beginning of Infinity, and I just love that idea. He talks about the physical topography of the island of Manhattan is no longer shaped by the forces of geology, because the physical topography of Manhattan now is shaped by the human mind and by human culture. Economics plays more of a role in the topography of Manhattan than geology does. So it's this idea that, like, the mind, the supposedly immaterial, is very material, and it's stronger than geology. So why cannot that be the fate of the whole universe? Substrate-independent minds faceting the universe, orchestrating the songs of the universe, as Marshall McLuhan said in his Playboy interview.
Sure. What I really like about this line, the way that I always kind of, is that I always use it to reflect on myself how, where I hold my limitations, where I think like, no, that's not good. No, we got to keep it here. We got to keep that under control. And it's sort of like the way that the avant-garde functioned in the art, in movements in like the 20s and 30s, you know, the Dadaists and the Surrealists. I mean, that stuff was really weird for most people who first encountered it. It was like, these guys are crazy. I mean, the avant-garde was really challenging for a little while. Now we read it, you know, in the history books, and we go, oh, how charming. Oh, the urinal in the bathroom, that's so cute. You know?
Totally.
But at the time, the avant-garde was really disturbing. I mean, they were really challenging our visions of what the human being is, and what I think is that the transhumanism now does that.
Transhumanism, that
you get those deep cultural challenges where you see what you're holding on to, where you see with you, whatever. And, you know, that's for me why I want to, for me it's always important to keep up with this kind of talk, even though a lot of the way that other people talk about it don't, there's sort of an argument about like how we should be thinking a certain kind of mechanistic way of thinking, or a kind of rational hedonism that I don't really like. It's the psychedelic aspect that seems more interesting to me, this kind of like quest to, like, you know, kind of sort of, you know, take the cream off the top of this, like, turbulent stew of natural history and just be like, enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love hearing you talk about psychedelics, because I think that one of the things that psychedelics do, right, is that at their very best, they can really, like, put us into a state of rapturous awe. It's like, wow, like, you're removed from context so powerfully that you are gawking in amazement at reality. And so I'm thinking, how can we make people understand technology in a more psychedelic way, in a more mind-manifesting way? Because isn't that what psychedelic means? Mind-manifesting. Well, guess what? If you were to look at all of human progress through time-lapse photography, you would see that it's all mind-manifesting. Somebody thought of something, and it came out in the form of jet engines and iPhones. Like, we literally think, and it becomes instantiated in the world. And that process at which that happens is getting faster and faster. So when we get to this event horizon, this singularity, it's going to be like a time-lapse photography. It's going to be like rendering existence into being at the speed of thought, you know?
See,
pulses
I don't know.
Of light.
Hold on, Manju, we got to roll up. We have like a minute left. And I just wanted to give Jason a moment if you wanted to point anybody to a website or something. We got about 30 seconds.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, well, my Twitter is @Jason_Silva. And I just want to tell you, thank you so much. I'm such a big fan. And as William Gibson recently said, in the future, we'll remember this time by the seeming distinction between virtual and real reality, because there really is no distinction.
Excellent. Well, Jason, thanks so much for being on the show. It was a blast to have you. I knew it was going to be fun somehow. I knew it was going to be extra fun.
Dude, you're the man. I'm a huge fan, so I'm honored. Thank you.
All right. Well, from me and Maja to all you mutants out there, keep your minds open.
See you soon. Thanks.